I'd like to bring the House Committee on Business and Labor to order February 15th, 2017. We're going to start at the top of the public hearing list today. So we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2164.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this is an measure that requires cities, counties, and other government entities that administer and enforce the building inspection program to provide an electronic access to building code information and services by January 1 of 2020. And today there are no amendments before you. And it's the first time the committee is hearing the bill.
Thank you. So we'll have John Killen, Brian Krieg, and Ryan Tribbett up first. Good afternoon. If you'd introduce yourself for the record before you speak, please.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, my name is Brian Krieg, and today I am here representing the Sheet Metal and Air Conditioning Contractors Association and the Plumbing and Mechanical Contractors Association. The bill before you is an issue that's of vital importance to our construction industry and being able to function efficiently and effectively in the current environment that we all live in. The details on the bill, Mr. Tribbett will handle some of that after the two of us give a little bit of framework, a little touch of history on it. Back in 2001, a lot of folks in the construction industry got together kind of forecasting where we were going with technology into the future. And part of the issue on that is we were realizing we would be able to start doing things as time went by electronically in the way of getting permits. The way it was in the past is to get a building permit after your plans have been approved. You would have to go into a local jurisdiction, take your check in, your paperwork in, and you would be processed there at a counter with staff. You would get the permit, and then you could go back out and do the actual work. What we saw is that technology was going to be advancing, so we would be able to start doing things over the Internet. We didn't have any idea that cell phones and the types of devices we all have now were really going to be available in the near future. But we did see that we'd be able to have the records that way. We'd also be able to probably track the records over time, just looking at there would be efficiencies. Now, knowing that, that was in the early days. We started talking about some legislation, and in 2003, we got the first little bit of it in, and then in 2005 more, where we launched a pilot program with the state, where we began a simplified system of getting permits, looking to build a bigger and more robust system. It was voluntary. Many different jurisdictions, large and small, participated and have over the years. We come to the present date, and what we have is, you know, it's around 15 years later. We have many jurisdictions in the state that are participating, and it's very helpful for our contractors, big time savings, cost savings. But we also still have jurisdictions that are not, and that is something that is becoming a bit of a problem in that we're trying to build our businesses not on having to drive to somewhere to go get the permits and do this in a physical capacity out there. And so I think the simple point that we're trying to make with the bill and wanting to work with the various parties on it is that we need to really come up with a time when we'll say the whole state will have caught up with this out there and put that out as a goal to make. And we're not going to be trying to force local jurisdictions to create their own system. They could use the state system. They can create their own system. They could start with one and then move to the other. The main thing would be is to have some consistency out there on a level and electronic access.
Thank you, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. My name is John Killen. I represent the Associated Wall and Ceiling Contractors of Oregon. My role here today is a couple parts. One, I was also here back in 01 and 03 and 05 and 07, and we've been working on this a long time, and we want to know when we can finally count on the ability to do these things online quickly and easily, both for the customers and for the contractors themselves. I also want to say that it's not just a electrical or plumbing issue. The wall and ceiling contractors are also interested. There are times where we have to get specialty permits for things like seismic, for fire, through a deferred submittal process with the general contractor. And those times we have to go and, well, my members have to go and figure out how to do these permits as well. And when they are in jurisdictions without the online permitting or online inspection request, it becomes very problematic to get those taken care of. With that, I'm be open to any questions.
For the record, Ryan Tribbett, we're here today on behalf of the National Electrical Contractors Association, and want to sort of reiterate the points of my colleagues here. I was the one responsible for sort of putting together the concept itself and submitting it for drafting, so I think I will explain a little bit about my thought process was and why we crafted it the way we did. So our contractors have, through our fee revenue, paid for the development of the state system, which we understand is available right now. In about 33 of the counties, of the 36 counties. It's not turned on and active because of the complicated relationship between states and the local jurisdictions. But our fee revenue is already paid for this system. In the areas where it operates, it works well. In the areas where the local governments have systems in place, we have not received a lot of complaints from our contractors about those. Our goal in this system was to say by the year 2020, you know, 3 years from now, that the state system would either flip the switch and to allow that service to be available that our contractors have already paid for, or if the local jurisdiction didn't want that or already had their own system in place, they could either continue using their system or they had a three-year ramp-up period to develop their own system if they were just adamant that they did not want the state system operating in their jurisdiction. And so we thought that that was a reasonable approach. I think we're willing to be more flexible than that even as well, and are happy to accept amendments if they local jurisdictions want some additional phasing or something like that. I think ultimately what we're looking for is this has been a 15-year pilot. We think it has been largely successful, and we're looking for a sort of date certain endpoint for the system to be available statewide.
Questions from the committee?
I have one.
Representative Bynum. Representative Hack.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there any thoughts or guarantees or reassurances that you might give cities and counties that the system will integrate, that the state system will integrate well with their systems? So if they've invested in their system and have spent a significant amount of money on their own, is there a way that we could ease their minds that the transition between or the connection between the states system and theirs is going to be able to connect well?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hack, I would be happy to work with them on language that would provide that sort of certainty for them. I'm willing to say, sort of on the record, the intention of the proponents of the bill is not to disqualify or to disallow a local jurisdiction who has their current system from using their current system. What we're trying to do is provide this electronic service in areas that don't have it. So, and I do understand that some of the people with existing systems in place have concerns with the bill, which I was initially surprised to hear, but I have tried to assure all of them, if they have concerns, that please provide us with language that would give them that sort of assurance in the bill.
Thank you.
Other questions? Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Ryan. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ryan, you mentioned 33 of the 36 counties have the availability. Is that the way you
said
it?
That's my understanding, correct.
Okay. And then how many can I follow up? So how many jurisdictions are on it right now in the pilot?
I do not have the information right in front of me, but the reason I don't is because I understand there is someone here from the department who's going to have that information as part of their testimony.
Okay. Thank you.
Other questions? So in listening to your testimony, it sounds like this isn't an immediate mandate that all cities join or jurisdictions join this system, but does it become a mandate in 2020?
Mr. Chair, no. It does not become a mandate that they use the state system. What is mandated in the bill is that the state system would go live in areas that didn't have an electronic system already in place. And for those jurisdictions who don't have one in place, there would be a 3-year timeline until January 1, 2020 that they could get a system in place if they didn't want the state system to be operating in their area.
And are we aware of any cost to those jurisdictions at that point? Any estimate of what that would be?
Mr. Chair, I don't know what the cost would be, but I believe the state system has been paid for already.
All right. No other questions? Thank you, gentlemen. Up next, Aaron Doyle and Eric Schmidt.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, for the record, Aaron Doyle here on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities. I'm going to speak a little bit broadly because we have an actual user here. Our concern with the way this bill is drafted right now is we do feel it does create something of a mandate by 2020. In 2015, when we removed the sunset on the pilot project, making the project for having a statewide e-permitting system permanent, we specifically negotiated that e-permitting would not become a mandate, that it would be a voluntary work by a local jurisdiction that has its own building inspection program, in part to protect those communities that have spent significant amounts of resources in creating their own, so that we didn't have to necessarily participate in the state system, but also in part to protect the resources of communities that might not be quite up to the capacity to do work with the state at this point in time, or, you know, not necessarily even by 2020. Even if the system exists, it can have a cost and a workload impact on a local building counter. Just because technology seems prevalent here in Salem, that doesn't necessarily mean that all of our cities and counties are capable of accessing the same level of service. I sometimes try to find information on our city's websites and discover we don't have them. I understand it's the state's e-permitting system, and they obviously have the portal available. It's a matter of getting it then to work at the local level. And with the budgets that we're looking at and the resources of employees that we might have, we want to be sure that we're protecting our employees. And we're going to look further into which jurisdictions aren't currently participating in any sort of electronic system to determine what the real level of impact is, and see if there is something to discuss as far as this goes. But as far as having jurisdictions participating in the state's program, but we're also significantly concerned about the second half of the concept that talks about having the department basically in the back of our locally developed systems, creates a lot of access issues, a lot of resource issues. We have a number of cities who have invested significantly because they want to integrate between a number of different departments beyond the building inspection program, and their systems are, of course, tailored specifically to their needs, and they have looked at the state system and decided it wouldn't work for their needs. And we want to maintain that without having rulemaking that might impact all of that, and then having a deadline that if we don't have a robust system in place in 3 years, we can't have one at all, which, as I feel like there's a joke about trying to do an IT contract correctly in 3 years, but I won't make it here. I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Yeah, go ahead.
Good afternoon, Chair Holvey and members of the committee. My name is Eric Schmidt, and I'm the Community Development Director and the Building Official for the City of Gresham, and also serving as the current president of the Oregon Building Officials Association. The Oregon Building Officials Association, or OBOA, represents more than 1,000 building officials and personnel throughout the state. Its members include a wide variety of building officials, both in large metropolitan cities and counties, as well as small rural jurisdictions. We appreciate the opportunity to submit comments today on this bill. For House Bill 2164, during the 2015 legislative session that the Senate passed, Senate Bill 133, which removed the sunset of the program, extended the definition to include construction-related services, and through extensive negotiations with stakeholders, including OBOA and the Building Codes Division, contained express language that the use of the state's e-permitting system was voluntary, and that a city or county that chooses not to use the system would not be sanctioned or disciplined by the state. OBOA has concerns about the proposed language outlined in 2164 and opposes the bill as currently drafted. Specifically, the House bill removes the voluntary nature of the program that was added just 2 years ago during the 2015 legislative session. Instead, the bill would require municipalities to be on the system by 2020 with rulemaking completed by 2019. And it also, the bill now explicitly states that the municipality may also be sanctioned for not using the system. While the bill includes language allowing jurisdictions using a system other than the department system to continue that use, that approval is dependent upon the state's sole approval. This approval system raises concerns for our members that have already spent or are currently spending substantial time and resources to build e-permitting systems that fit the needs for their specific jurisdiction and their customers. We understand and believe that the current system is used by and provides value to many OBOA members, primarily smaller rural jurisdictions. OBOA supports this continued current use of the e-permitting system for those jurisdictions that choose to use it. We were able to have an initial conversation with the proponents of the bill earlier this week and would welcome the opportunity to work with you and the proponents of the bill to explore options to address their primary needs and concerns while also helping protect the need for flexibility that was included in the bill 2 years ago and allow jurisdictions to have certainty as they move forward with meeting their individual and customer needs. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Representative Bynum.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your testimony. My question is, how much effort would it take for us to get the entire state to a 100% e-permitting system?
Chair Holvey, Vice Chair Bynum, I don't know. Because I don't know how many jurisdictions aren't currently participating that have local programs, and I'm certain if what the costs are that I'm looking into what the costs are. I think that's also a question that maybe the Building Codes Division might be able to help answer if we can work together to figure out what that would take.
Follow up.
Given that we have a housing crisis, one of the pieces of feedback that the building community has is that it's too difficult to do business, and I want to make sure that the cities are on board with making it as easy as possible for us to build the housing that we need as quickly and as safely as we can.
Chair Holder, Representative Bynum, we do want to see housing built. We want to see it done efficiently, quickly, but we also need to make sure that our resources are there, because even if there is a system out there, if it doesn't work with how our local jurisdictions are working, it won't matter if the e-permitting system is there if on our end we can't respond to the electronic portion of it if we're using the state system. So I think in our larger communities that have seen robust growth in the last few years, they are working locally to create their own local system, and therefore they're working really diligently to make sure that those things are online. I know I'm imagining Gresham could probably talk to how that works, but in our smaller communities, it might be a matter of they don't see a ton of permitting coming across, and so they haven't invested in the system. So it's a matter of which jurisdictions are and aren't participating currently, and figuring out the why and the how we can get them online faster to address the needs of their community.
Thank you.
Any other questions for this panel? Representative Fahey.
So, thank you, Mr. Chair. You've referenced a couple of times smaller communities that might not have the resources, smaller jurisdictions. Can you just say a little bit more about the, I understand that a smaller jurisdiction might not have the resources to develop their own system, and that's understandable, but what would the practical barriers be for a smaller jurisdiction joining the statewide system that's already been developed?
Chair Holby, Representative Fahey, I think for depends upon the smaller jurisdiction as well, because if the jurisdiction is too small to be able to have an inspection program, this is a moot point. Obviously, the state would be covering those areas. Those that are somewhere in the middle, they might have technological barriers to access that where they're trying to update their own IT systems. We're not all on Microsoft 2010 necessarily, and it's 2017. That's an exaggeration, of course. It's a matter of making sure that our internal IT resources match up with what they have and that we are on the same page technologically as the e-permitting system at the state level. And how we budget for a year and how we can get to that point and continue to do all of the things, I can plead finances till the sun sets, but it's a matter of how we prioritize those resources and what we're able to do with them to make sure that technologically we're on the same page and getting the things from the state system into the local counter to make sure that we're, when this, for example, if the inspector is scheduled, that they actually get the notification of the schedule and that it's all working copacetically. We're trying to find some of those jurisdictions now that we kind of gotten a better sense of what the problem is from the stakeholders to figure out what those barriers are and why there hasn't been, you know, everybody jumping on board to roll into the state's permitting system. The other piece of it is it wasn't a permanent system until 2015. So as it rolls out, it takes time for, you know, a pilot project to become a statewide project. And it's been less than 2 years since that occurred that we've had any guarantee that it was going to be a permanent state e-permitting system. And so we need some time to let that roll out. And I'm not sure that 2020 is, you know, the right date. And that's, again, part of the conversation I need to have with my folks who haven't adopted at this point.
One more question.
Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So then it says on page 2, line 3, municipality is not required to use the department system if the municipality uses a system that is approved by the department. So the department actually has to approve each one of these systems that are already being developed or may already be developed out there.
Chair Holdy, Representative Barreto, yes, that's my understanding as well. And that, the if I might, for the good of the committee, one of the challenges with implementing a state building permit system is that's one system. And in a local municipality, there are many systems that we're working with daily that need to, you know, communicate, whether it's business licensing, HR, you know, planning, engineering, you name it. There's a whole multitude of systems. And so that a lot of jurisdictions, when they're working on this, from my understanding, and both from, again, speaking from Gresham's perspective, but also our members, we understand we're sensitive to the customer's needs, and we certainly hear from the proponents of what the needs are and what they're trying to achieve. And so I think there are opportunities for us to try and meet the needs of what they have on the simple, straightforward kinds of permits. But when there's other complexities get involved with larger projects and other departments and things like that, it gets more complex. So I think that hopefully that kind of helps give a little bit of context. I'm sorry if I didn't answer your question directly, but I'm happy to do so.
Follow up. Then what you're saying is, Bill, might be a little premature forcing you into doing this within 3 years.
Chair Holby, Representative Barreto, I think the understanding the primary concerns from the proponents, I think there are other opportunities for us to explore. So it may be, yes, that timeline is going to be difficult for a lot of municipalities to be able to make. And I think it's about more of having a system that works with jurisdictions, but also understanding how it needs to meet the needs for the development community. And I think that's where I think some additional discussion, and we welcome some of that discussion to take place.
Thank you.
Representative Hack.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So along the same lines, if the department has to approve the plan or the software used or whatever, will there be, or maybe this isn't a question for you, a set of guidelines for folks to follow so that those that who don't have it and are working toward that know what they're working toward, so it isn't a blind, we're building a set of software here, we're working down this road, but then we in fear that it won't be approved? Is there going to be,
Representative Holby, I'm sorry, Chair Holvey, Representative Hack. I think that question's probably best for the Building Codes Division. I think my understanding is there would be rulemaking that would go with that, okay, that would certainly have to play its process out. But that's from the jurisdiction's standpoint, that can be concerning because, again, it minimizes certainty about how we move forward. And concerned with needing to have that ability to meet our needs as well as the needs of the development community, so it gets a little bit more difficult.
And if I may, I think there's a little bit of separation here that we need to make. For those that currently already have a system, if the rules come out a different way, it may actually require them to significantly adjust these systems that they may have been working with for years now, that they have specifically designed to meet the needs of the customers that they have, and both internally within the departments within the city or county, and those externally that come in for the permits or use their e-permitting system. The bill is drafted currently, sets the rulemaking deadline for 2019, and then we have to meet those rules by 2020. And if there's any changes that have to be made to a system, that could be extremely problematic as well.
One of the challenges that a statewide mandated system has is even the vendor that the state has chosen is a good vendor, and a lot of other jurisdictions are actually using that vendor, but they are choosing to use the vendor directly versus the state because, again, of the need for the vendor for everything to tie in with the jurisdiction's other systems. And so if there are necessary upgrades on the financial system or other systems not with the building permit, they need to be able to do a holistic upgrade and not be beholden to the state for updates as well, because we need the jurisdictions to be able to, the systems need to be able to be integrated.
Thank you. Appreciate your testimony today. Mark Long, would you like to weigh in at this point?
Sure, Mr. Chairman. If I could bring my permitting manager up, that would be helpful in case there's a...
It's been a few references to the Building Codes Division being able to answer some of these questions. So,
okay.
I guess we didn't see that you were coming. I didn't see you had a presentation for us.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Mark Long, Administrator of Building Codes, and I have to my right, your left, Selena Patterson, the manager of our e-permitting program. I just have you've already had a lot of testimony. I was going to try to tee this up for you. I'll just go through our PowerPoint real quick. It'll answer some of your questions, and then we can go from there, because I know you got a heavy agenda today. So if you kind of listen to the proponents, it's really about what are some of the services, and you can see the system that the state put together. Again, starting off in 2003 with changes in 5 and 7, we fully started our first communities in 2010, and we have about 65 communities right now, which is one of the questions. And it just allows folks to go to a single place.
How many counties?
I believe there's 33 after you're done this year. Is that correct? 25. Actually using it. So it creates a single point for folks to access the information, do an address location. It gets all the information kind of through a one-stop shopping experience. You can see the rest. Like I say, I'll kind of go quickly. Gives you online permit status, emails to the contractors, back and forth to the community, lets everybody kind of see what's going on. Alerts, electronic plan review is important to some of the customers so they can do those transactions kind of seamlessly. And if you kind of think about the future, everybody's going to the smartphones and we're moving to kind of an app-based technology. So you can do right now through our system, you can use kind of the old, you use your computer online, you can use the phone, which is called IVR, it's pretty clunky, or you can use a mobile app to schedule your inspections as a contractor. And then for the inspectors, we actually have the inspectors out using their phones, and they can kind of final the project and send notices to the contractor electronically, which we find that to be pretty useful. Here's the list of the cities and counties. And so you can see when we talk about full service, those are the communities that are using the program that went in 2010, because we started in 2003. We had a pilot, and it was very limited. What I used to call quick permits, and still call it, are just some basic over-the-counter services limited to the plumbing and electrical, and I think you got mechanical in there as well. Some very basic permits. The full service allows, again, the full range of things that can be done in all the services that we talked about. And then we've tried to identify some of the communities out there that have their own system that's not part of ours that do provide electronic transactions to their consumers. Now, again, this isn't exhaustive because it's our best information of the 130 communities out there providing building inspection services, but you can see those communities provide. And then next up, we constantly have a list of communities we're putting in place, and Celine and her team will be turning, loading up. I think you're working in Wallowa County coming up soon, and Union, LeGrand. I know you've got some stuff out in Clatsop. So we try to get a community up and running at a rate of about one every two or three months throughout the year. Is that about right? So, and that, again, under the current model, it's voluntary. So they contact us. We give them a demonstration. We work through the various issues. And then we get them live and running so that they can provide those services to those communities. Just as, again, here's just a visual picture of the counties using it. Here's the cities. That's kind of hard to see. And then just to kind of give you a sense of scale, on an annual basis, there's about 260,000 building permits issued by local government. That's a lot of transactions for remodels and new buildings. And through our system, we've got about 90,000 of those going on. So we have probably more communities than 50% of the communities, but we have quite a bit less of the transactions because it's in a lot of the smaller communities coming through there. So it kind of gives you a sense of the scale of what's going on. With that, I went through it quite quickly because I know you've already received quite a bit of testimony. I think that concludes what it does. Mr. Chair, any questions for us?
So, questions for the division? So, are you, you know, since you're uploading these to communities already, what kind of cost do they incur to this? Is the system paid for? You know, that's what I'm hearing. So there's, I mean, what kind of cost is there to a city or county that wants to start using this system?
Sure, Mr. Chair. So the licensing costs and the maintenance costs are paid for, and all the development costs are paid by the state through a system of collecting surcharges off of every building permit. You heard the contractor say they've kind of already paid for it. I also think you provide the upgrades, is that correct, when the new models come out from our vendor? So what the communities have to do, and Celine will again correct me if I'm wrong, is they give us their address information that's in their community. We need to have that, and so that creates a workload, if you will. They need to set up a bank account, I think. Is that correct? And what else?
Hardware, if they want to buy new monitors or if they want to buy their inspector's mobile apps. There are some costs associated with that, but that's not a requirement. That's only if they want to use those tools.
So a lot of kind of in-kind, if you will, but as far as direct for the building permit side. And you heard testimony that in some communities they want it to branch across the various different things that they do that aren't related to building. And in 2015, we received permission from the legislature to expand it into what we call construction-related services. You heard that testimony. So we provide a module for public works. We provide a module for planning. We just went live with DEQ. So that we can coordinate site septic services with building services. So there's kind of ongoing development of this as we make the services available to those communities.
Any questions, Representative Fahey?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So since you actually work with these systems, helping cities and counties implement them, what are some of the barriers that some of the jurisdictions encounter when they try to implement the systems?
Chair Holvey, Representative Fahey. Well, it's a web-based program, so they don't actually have to download anything onto their local network. So basically, if you can get to the internet, you can get to our system. So in terms of resources, again, it's mostly just the hardware and what Mark mentioned in terms of like getting us an address and a parcel and owner load, which usually involves working with their assessor's office to get a load of that data and sometimes some IT resources to do that.
Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony and your quick little slide presentation. I know you're going to be around for some other bills, too. So, up next, I'd like to call Andy Smith and Ethan Nelson.
Chair Holvey.
Members of the Committee. For the record, my name is Ethan Nelson. I'm with the City of Eugene. And I represent our intergovernmental affairs, but I've also spent time in our Buildings Codes Division. And where we are, you've heard from colleagues in Hillsboro and LOC and also from BCD and the proponents. And I think all of those items, I just want to add a little bit more of a Eugene experience in. So in 2013, the legislature approved Senate Bill 582, which basically really kind of gave direction for municipalities to make their development, their construction development services more efficient, more kind of consistent, and also to support economic development. And so Eugene did that, and we spent about a year looking into our e-permitting system and looking to then create a much more internet-based system. We worked for about a year with Acela, with the state's contractor, to figure out how we could implement that program and that system within Eugene's network of building permits and land use permits, and basically our kind of the network that we had already set up of applications and systems. And we were unable to use Acela because it wasn't the contractor wasn't going to be able to service the needs of what we felt were for our city operations, but also for the community to support our customers. And so we developed our own, and as the director showed, a homegrown system, and we built what's called eBuild. And within time that we put that together in 2013, we are now processing 80% of all permits run through Eugene's e-build system, and we expect by mid to late 2017 that we will have 100% of all of our projects running through our homegrown e-build system. And what does that provide? Well, it provides 24/7 access to the via internet. There's no waiting in the office hours. And that includes permit application, plan submittals, payment of fees, selecting of contractors, scheduling of inspections. It eliminates trips to permit center, reduces travel time and cost, reducing printing costs for applicants, and also there's improved communication and collaboration with our plan reviewers, which really kind of makes it easier and more cost effective. That's what we continue to hear, and so we take action to do that at the local level. The cost to develop our e-build system over the course of time was roughly about $1.2 million. And that includes all of the technology platform and the system development and working with our ISD, which is our Informational Services Division, to actually develop the system to then implement and integrate with our existing business systems. And so we wanted to have something that was flexible and also met the needs of our customers and could grow with us. Currently, we've got about a $500,000 renovation to our permit center, and that's to really be able to allow customers to come in, and if they've still got paper copies, we will be able to get them to become digitalized. And as staff from BCD spoke about, there is large equipment needs. When you move from a paper system where you've got large plan sets coming in, you've got your office set on up and configured in one way, and then you move to take those large plan sets and then be able to have to look at them onto a video screen, that's a major shift for staff and for labor. And so there's a lot of equipment, training, and also then redesign of the workspace. And so there's associated costs that come with that that are fairly significant. The impact, what we see is the fiscal impact of HB 2164 as currently written is that we will lose that $1.2 million investment. There are more than likely we have an estimated $700,000 in converting over to a state Acela system. And that's also considered conservative because it's uncertain the extent of customizations that would be required to integrate the state system with our other city applications, which is what you heard from my colleague from Hillsboro. And also, this is not considered costs associated with the lack of reliability of Acela. We've seen a lot of notifications about outages and processing challenges that are fairly common.
the impact on services, our business model and customer service philosophy will drastically change. And so if we're saying we're being proactive and helping the business community get in and get out, we're going to have to once again retool that and have that change. Our permitting system would be less flexible and responsive and efficient, and it would eliminate the ability to develop our local system needs to meet our specific and unique local needs. And we would also lose control over our system development, maintenance, and enhancements and release of new versions. So for those reasons, we oppose HB 2164 as currently written, because it has those major financial and customer service impacts to the community and businesses in Eugene.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, my name is Andy Smith. I'm the government relations manager for the city of Hillsborough. Here today in opposition to House Bill 2164, our building department director couldn't be here today, but her written comments are in the record for your reference, and they touch on several of the bills you'll be hearing this afternoon. But I just want to take a minute to put a little finer point on our concerns with this bill in particular. Hillsborough's e-permitting system took about 5 years and cost well over $2 million to implement. And our system was developed to be customized and tailored for the type of large-scale industrial, commercial, and residential developments occurring in our city. This bill would require us to either move to the state system, in which case we lose the time and investment and the customization that our system affords to our customers, or our system would be subject to state oversight and approval, the details of which would be rules promulgated by the department pursuant to this legislation. In this scenario, even minor modifications to our system that would have to be made to be in compliance with the rules could take months to implement and may have very serious cost implications. And our concerns would persist into the future as the rules may change and modify over time, creating uncertainty about what additional modifications we may have to make to our system down the road, with no real clear public benefit to those changes. So, Mr. Chair, for those reasons, we're opposed to the bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions from this panel? No questions for this panel. Thank you very much for your testimony. Up next, Aaron Van Fleet, Sean Miller, and Nathan Phillips.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Sean Miller. I'm here today on behalf of the independent electrical contractors in support of House Bill 2164. And I just wanted to just kind of clarify what the bill does, the intent of the bill, because the previous panel from Hillsborough and Eugene, you know, these aren't building programs that we're actually going after. We're not trying to roll back existing programs where they've invested money in technology. We're trying to get at the communities that don't have these consistent standards. And so I want to be clear that, you know, we've developed and worked very hard on a statewide e-permitting program. We have some that are out this state. We have some local jurisdictions that choose to do their own program, which is fine, and that's their prerogative. But we have so many different standards, and we want to create that standard of service from an e-permitting process. And so with me today is Aaron Van Vliet from Triton Communications. Kind of go through some examples of what we're talking about, because, you know, again, there's several jurisdictions, and I don't know where in the bill, and I still can't see in the bill where this would roll back those existing programs like Hillsborough and Eugene, which I'd say have good programs. And these are exactly the things that we want to see. And so there's other programs, and I think Representative Fahey asked questions of how smaller programs get involved in these. The state program does very well for those smaller programs. I know in Representative Barreto's district, we have Wallowa County and some of those real small building programs coming online soon. So if it can work there, it can work just about anywhere is how we look at it. So, you know, again, I think we want to clarify that we're trying to get those standards in place for those who don't want to do it or choose not to do it. And, again, this is customer service to the contractor and down to the consumer. Ultimately, I think, to represent Bynum's point, being able to develop and build. And so I want to just let Aaron talk about some of the practical examples, because he's in the field every day dealing with this. So, thank you.
Chair Holvey, members of the board, thank you for your time today. My name is Aaron Van Fleet with Triton Communications. I'm a small, low-voltage electrical contractor. We service the entire state of Oregon and Washington. A lot of times we will get phone calls from customers 5 o'clock at night, went in an emergency job next morning. We needed to get down there and take care of it. With the e-permitting system, we're able to pull the permit online at any time of the day and have the permit in our hands and ready to go for the job at 7 o'clock in the morning the next morning. This is very handy for us and for our customers. It provides great customer service. When we have a jurisdiction where we have to travel some distance to get to and we're not able to pull the permit online, sometimes we have to send the technician with a live check to City Hall. They're not open until 9 o'clock. We're not able to start the work. The customer is affected by timelines and constraints. So those are some of the concerns that way. Some of the other excellent advantages with the online permitting system is the feedback that we get when permits are called in for final. We get notification that those have been taken care of and dealt with, and the customer is squared away. If there's an issue with a jurisdiction that does not have reporting, or we might not find out that the permit was not finaled for weeks, and then the customer is then notified by the city that you have an open permit on your job, and they're getting notices by the city or the jurisdiction, and then we're hearing about it weeks later when we could have dealt with it right away if we'd gotten a notification from the city that the inspection either failed for some reason, maybe there was a small thing that needed to be taken care of. We could have fixed it right away instead of it going on and on and on. Mr. Chair, if it's okay, I have an example. I can play a voicemail example so the committee can hear some of the one example of a system out there that for calling in permits, it's very cumbersome and leaves a lot of room for miscommunication. And if it's okay, I can play that.
Well, you know, I've really got a lot of people left to testify. I think we can imagine from your description what it would be like.
Yeah,
so.
And just to clarify, Mr. Chair, we don't need to play it, but what it does is it basically makes you call in and leave a detailed voicemail for the inspection instructions. So if they don't get that right or they don't listen to the voicemail, they'll fail the inspection. This all on the e-permitting system is very efficient.
Get the point. Mm-hmm. No, thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Nathan Phillips. I'm also a small electrical contractor down in Eugene. And in addition to that, I have a real estate property management and development company. So I deal with these building permits both on the small scale as an electrical contractor and on a larger scale on the building projects that we do. Electrical and building permits are not inexpensive. They're quite expensive sometimes, and we think the jurisdictions that sell them ought to be required to use the money that we pay to provide an acceptable level of customer service. Online permitting has been highly successful and efficient for customers. We do a lot of our work in Eugene, and we use the e-build system you heard about and would say that it has been very successful for us. As part of the group that has been advocating for statewide e-permitting, I want to reassure you, as Sean did, that we are not seeking to cause cities that have already implemented e-permitting to change their systems. We're trying to get a statewide system so that everywhere we work, we can buy permits. Some local governments have not yet made e-permitting available, which causes us to sometimes have to drive great distances to purchase a permit or even just to sign a permit. Sometimes even determining which city the property is located in can be a challenge. For example, in the metro area where you have an intersection where each of the four corners is in a different city. The e-permitting system has alleviated that challenge greatly because you just put in the address and it tells you what jurisdiction you're in. Since the advent of e-permitting, we've used it extensively and we've had little or no problems. Driving to jurisdictions around the county and the state to sign a permit is a thing of the past in jurisdictions where e-permitting is available, which has improved our efficiency and our customer service greatly. Selling building permits is a statewide business with annual revenues that I've heard exceed $150 million. The state has developed the infrastructure to provide online services to this business throughout the state. While there may be difficulties in implementation, they're not insurmountable, and with amendments, this bill can work. Local government should be required to make use of the system or develop their own and provide a level of service to their customers that's commensurate with the high fees that we're paying. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions for this panel? Not seeing. Thank you for your testimony. I think you presented the committee with a clear issue that we'll have to consider. So, with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2164. I am going to skip to the bottom of the calendar and open a public hearing on House Bill 2544. Jan, can you give us a quick description of the bill?
Mr. Chair, it's a measure that allows the issuance of electrical permits to the electrical contractor who's contracting for services of a general supervising electrician. It allows part-time employment of the general supervising electrician by an electrical contractor, and allows the general supervising contractor to provide services under contract to the electrical contractor. There's a dash one amendment that is before you today. It's from Representative Hack, and it specifies that the licensed general supervising electrician must be employed on a continuous basis by the contractor or under contract on a for continuous services.
Let's start with Representative Hack.
Thank you.
Introduce yourself for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, members of the committee. Representative Jody Hack, and I represent House District 19, which is parts of South Salem, Almsville, and Turner. This issue was brought to me by a constituent, and I'm sure you're going to hear lots of good information by those who know a whole lot more about the issue than I do today. My understanding of it is that the way the law reads now, electrical companies are required to have a signing supervising electrician employed full-time on a 40-hour-a-week basis, whether or not they utilize a signing supervisor for 40 hours. My understanding, which is not a lot, so I'm sure you're going to hear more again, is that the signing supervisors responsible for signing off on the permitting and the plans for the electrical work, and then again signing off when they start the job and signing off when they finish. The reason it was brought to me is that it came to my attention because there are small electrical companies who don't have a need to have a signing supervisor on staff for the full 40 hours and would like to have the option of not having to be required to have a full-time employee that they just don't need. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to a whole lot of other people that know a lot more about this issue than I do. So thank you.
Are there any questions for Representative Hack? I guess you're off the hook.
That's a good thing.
I just threw that out there for fun. Let's have James Douglas. Somebody McDowell and Mike Weiss. I can't read the printing on your McDowell's name, so. If you'd introduce yourself for the record, please, and give us your testimony.
Yes, Chairman, and my name is James Douglas. I'm a general journeyman electrician. And I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 2544. Been in electrical trade for many years. I've done a lot of electrical contracting work in commercial and industrial and largely in residential. My job sometimes requires me to travel two or three days at a time, which can be a major inconvenience for myself. My wife has had major medical issues for the last 10 years that require me to miss a lot of work. Now she needs full-time care, which I cannot afford. But my best option around all this would be to start my own business so I can set out my own schedule. This way I could attend to my wife and her needs in a better way. But anyways, this is also causing huge scheduling issues with my current employer and anybody else who I may work for in the future. This House Bill 2544 would help me start my business by allowing me to hire a part-time signing supervisor, which will allow me to spend more time with my wife and incur less costs, operating costs to start up with. For now, my employer has been letting me take off a lot of time so I can take care of my wife. And to do this on my own, I would need an employee supervisor to sign for me. This would cost me at least $20,000 to get started with my own business, not including losing my health care, which I would not be able to afford anymore, and for my wife. Then on top of that, I'd have to pay a full-time signing supervisor, whether I needed him or not, just as a two-man shop is what that would bring me in. And this would all have to happen just to be compliant with the current administrative rules. The House Bill 2544 would also make starting a business here in Oregon just a lot less stressful for people in my particular situation and give people like myself much better chance, you know, at success. And also to ease the burden with current employers. So if I was going to start my own business, I could transition, whether I get a license myself to do my own supervising, to sign for my own permits, going that route, there would be a huge gap in the current way it's set up. So I wouldn't leave my current employer in a hole, so to say, because to do a soft start, which would be easier on myself and my current employer, I would have the new bill, House Bill 2544, would allow that, so I could possibly sign for somebody else or myself to get things started, but also allow a transition to leave the company and not leave a gap where he would need to hire somebody immediately. And because I'm involved in a lot of training with apprentices and stuff like that, so it would make transitional for new businesses way easier and more affordable, for that matter.
Thank you. Go ahead. Go next.
Chairman Halvey and members of the committee, my name's Mike Weiss. I own M&S Electric, and I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 244 or 2544 and the proposed amendment. The need for the bill has been created by a shift in a policy the agency charged with supervision of electrical contractors. Specifically, the agency has redefined and interpreted the definition continuously employed in such a way that contradicts the legislator's intent and is designed to shut down small businesses in Oregon. House Bill 2544 allows for assigning supervisors to be employed on a part-time basis, and that a proposed amendment fixes the agency's bizarre definition of continuously employed so that the definition serves the legislator's purpose. A couple of the issues are the current definition restricts signing supervisors from owning or even being part of another business or employment opportunity during the hours of operation of his or her electrical company. By the board's definition and interpretation, in times of bad economy or between large projects, the electrical contractor must keep paying the supervisor a full-time wage, even though the rest of the employees could be laid off, even during periods of when the contractor isn't performing any electrical work at all. The current definition is a one-size-fits-all rule, no matter if you're a sole proprietor or employ 500 people. That allows the board to impose fines and suspensions that are crippling, end up closing down Oregon small businesses. The current definition is also majorly impacts any new startup company. The average small electrical company is approximately will accrue about $30,000 to $50,000 in debt before he can even bid work. The first year, as we all know, is the biggest struggle financially and is the most critical year to know if it will be a lasting or sustainable small business here in Oregon. By having no choice but to pay another employee full-time wages before you even receive your first payment for the work you have done, it should be a mutual decision between the employer and the employee on pay or compensation of the supervisor role, not the agency's. Most journeymen electricians who challenge the supervisor test don't want to be business owners. Typically, it's wanted to increase their current wages or become an electrical inspector down the road. In early 2000, the electrical board rewrote the supervisor exam. By doing this, the passing rate of the exam went from 75% down to about 5% in the same year. Excuse me, I got a dry mouth. The average attempts to take the test are 2 to 3 times before passing after you've taken a 6-week prep course for the exam. This has created a demand for supervisors in small emerging businesses. House Bill 2544 will help accommodate the rising demand across the state by allowing assigning supervisors to be employed part-time. We as contractors shouldn't have to worry about license suspensions and being fined. Thank you. Excuse me. License suspensions and being fined over a misinterpretation of the agency's definition of two words in the administrative rules that contradict the laws of the state of Oregon that is not being used in the manner it was intended for. Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members of the panel, my name is Leonard McDowell. I work presently at the City of Portland as an electrical inspector, and so I've also served as a assignment supervisor and a journeyman in the field for large and small companies. And mainly I wanted to present myself for any questions from the different perspectives. There's been some discussion on full-time, 40 hours devoted to the work as a assigning supervisor in the field. Practically speaking, I've interviewed many assigning supervisors up to the largest companies, and what I've found is rarely does the assigning supervisor work full-time 40 hours on supervising. Many times they're working on safety classes, continuing education classes, other responsibilities on the job. I've interviewed some and asked point blank when I've called inspections, are you familiar with this job? And I've been told straight up, well, no. That's what the journeymen on the job are supposed to do. They're supposed to run the work there and meet their license requirements. And I'm on call for advice, and then I've been told we have too much work for me to be familiar with all these jobs. So just by de facto, there's too much to be kept track of to work 40 full hours on as assigning supervisor. So it could be two supervisors might be required for the volume of work, or it could be a partial supervisor for the volume of work. So again, I just want to repeat that I would like to be able to answer anything from the different perspectives.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Questions from the committee? Thanks. It'd be great if you're able to, you know, get us your testimony in writing. We don't absolutely need it, but because you've made a lot of points we'd like to look at, perhaps. Thank you. Thank you all three for testifying on House Bill 2544. Up next, Nathan Phillips, Tim Frew, John Jensen. Go ahead, please. And reintroduce yourself again.
Good afternoon, Representative Colvey and members of the committee. My name is Nathan Phillips, and I'm here now speaking, representing NECA on this bill, the National Electrical Contractors Association. We oppose contracting out for signing supervisors. This is an issue that we've been fighting with for 25 years. We have credible reports of supervisors who live out of state, never visit the shop, are bedridden, and we even have had signing supervisors who are deceased. The authority of the signing supervisor is that of a licensed professional electrical engineer. As a signing supervisor, which I am, I can design and build any electrical systems in the state without the signature of a professional engineer. That's why we have robust requirements in place for signing supervisors. The existing rules were developed to put in place requirements so that the signing supervisor is actually providing their supervisory and design role. It's not just an administrative function signing the permits. You're actually required to assure that the work is done by licensed people and that it's done safely. Obtaining a signing supervisor's license is not an insurmountable obstacle for folks wanting to start their own business. That's what I did when I started Phillips Electric in 1980 as a one-man shop.
I had a newborn baby and a wife recovering from a C-section, so I know what it was like to take care of my family under those circumstances, and I managed to do it. One does need to demonstrate that they have the skills and knowledge necessary to protect the life and property of Oregonians through the safe use of electricity. And I just have to say one thing about the previous testimony. I've served as a volunteer at Building Codes Division for many years on the committee that writes and reviews the examination for siting supervisors. It's not true that the pass rate is 5%. While it's not an easy exam, it's not full of trick questions. We work very hard to make sure that it is understandable and that people can pass it, and qualified candidates are passing it routinely all the time. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Holvey and members of the committee. Tim Frew, Oregon State Building Trades. I just want to go on record as not being in favor of this bill for the reasons that were previously stated. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. My name is John Jensen. I represent IBEW Local 48. We're a group of over 3,000 electrical professionals in the Portland metropolitan region. I also want to go on record in opposition to this bill. The only thing I'll add is that I appreciate that, you know, assigning super's job, those duties might not take up a full-time position for a person, but I think it's really important for our electrical contractors to have an actual valid employee who has the competency level to understand all elements of electrical installation and design. I think it's in the public interest and in the industry's interest to keep that that full-time actual employee. So thank you.
Questions? Representative Hurd.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sir, I didn't catch your name on the far right here.
Nathan Phillips.
Nathan. Mr. Phillips, you said that the pass rate is not 5%. What is the pass rate?
Representative Hurd, through the chair, I was hoping you wouldn't ask me that question. I don't know what it is.
You can always get back to us with that information.
It's well in excess of. There was a time when the pass rate was dipping down below 60%, and we started to really examine the questions and make sure that they were understandable and passable, and I think the rate's well above that now, but I don't know. Maybe the Building Codes Division reps here know.
One follow-up, please.
Follow-up.
It would be interesting to see if there has been a fall off in passing scores. What's the trend been and whatnot, and what has caused that to happen?
So. Yeah, I know the trend is, Representative Hurd, I know the trend is that the pass rate is increasing since we really took a tough look at the questions and made sure they were coherent and easy to understand and consistent.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I could add one more thing, too, if I could, Mr. Chair. The rules do not require that the signing supervisor be employed full-time. They require that the signing supervisor be employed during the time when the work is being performed. So if you had a small shop that only worked 2 days a week, you could have a supervisor that was available and employed 2 days a week.
Thank you. You hit my question. Representative Kinnemer.
Thank you. I guess the question, which is higher paying, a supervising electrician or a journeyman? And is it a significant difference in pay? Do you guys know?
Well, Representative Kinnemer, through the chair, the signing supervisor is typically paid more than a journeyman, but not always. I don't know what.
Through the chair, Representative Kinnemer, I'm a general journeyman electrician in the state of Oregon for over 25 years, and it's been my experience that the signing supervisor is compensated for his work and his level of expertise.
Thank you.
And I assume, you know, just following up on your addition to the kind of answering my question, a signing supervisor doesn't have to work full time as a signing supervisor. They could also work as a journeyman electrician if they wanted, or sweeping floors or anything.
That's true, Representative Foley. The signing supervisor is a licensed electrician. So in many small shops, like the one that I started, the signing supervisor performs those supervisory functions and also makes the electrical installations. So
I just noted I saw you with a broom once.
Is it appropriate if I ask a question since I'm not sure of this?
Sure.
Representative Hack. So if they're brought on as the signing supervisor, can they drop down on the same job? So if they're brought on as the signing supervisor, they sign off. Can they drop down as a journeyman on the same job, or do they have to stay as a signing supervisor on that job?
Through the chair, Representative Hack, so the way the licensing structure works is it's hierarchical, and a journeyman is a lower level license than a signing supervisor, and each step up on the licensing scale can perform the work of the lower licenses.
But you have to be paid the higher license rate.
The pay rate is a subject of either the bargaining agreement if you're union or whatever agreement you have with your employer. So whether if an employer wanted to pay someone a different rate for providing different services, they could. I don't think that's typical. I think typically there's an hourly rate or a salary paid to a signing supervisor for whatever work they perform.
So can I just clarify?
Follow up.
So thank you, Mr. Chair. So if the agreement is that a supervising electrician's paid X amount of dollars, they can drop down, perform the duties of a journeyman, but they still would be paid the supervising wage if that's what they were brought in at the supervisor's wage.
Through the chair, Representative Hack, that's really a subject of whatever agreement exists between the employee and the employer.
Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate your testimony today. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2544. If you're waiting for House Bill 2168, we will not get to that bill today. But I am going to open the public hearing on House Bill 2165 and 2737 concurrently. So, Jen, could you give us a brief description of the bills and maybe a potential amendment to clarify one of them?
Mr. Chair and committee members, House Bill 2165, brought to you by the committee, it requires small homes to be inspected for compliance with the recreational vehicle building code if the home is not permanently sited. And it requires small homes that are permanently sited for use as residences to be inspected for compliance under the residential building code. There are no amendments. House Bill 2737 is a measure that was sponsored by Representative Barnhart. It requires the director of DCBS to establish special construction codes for homes that have floor area that's not exceeding 250 square feet, and it identifies provisions that must be included in the code. There are no amendments on that bill either.
Thank you. So let's start off with Mark Long. We do have a long list of testifiers, and it's likely that we won't get through all the testifiers, so we'll probably be carrying this bill over. So if you can't make it back, try to let us know so we can get you in today. So thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Again, for the record, Mark Long, Administrator of State Building Codes. I have a PowerPoint just to kind of set the issues around tiny houses and RVs and dwellings, and to kind of follow up on our conversation we had in September on the issue. So I'll try to go quickly, and then, of course, stop me if you have any questions. Just to remind the committee what we do at Building Codes, amongst e-permitting and the other things you've already heard about, is we adopt code standards for all the construction around the state. We do license subcontractors, electricians, plumbers, folks that work in the boiler, elevator industry, and through our system, local government carries out the inspections. I think you've heard that. The primary purpose of our system, as I've communicated before, is to ensure that there's equal protection statewide, no matter where somebody lives and their social economic status, and we also make sure that we create a level playing field for the contractors. You've heard that's very important as well. In the last meeting, we talked about kind of residential codes. We talked about mobile home codes, RV codes, et cetera. Today, I want to kind of update you on our staff action, discuss some of the licensing requirements that we've identified since we last spoke to you, share with you our attempt to try to differentiate between temporary structures and permanent dwellings, which is an ongoing challenge. And I've got some pictures and hopefully show you that there's a path to do this work legally, although we haven't seen much of that here lately. Just for the record, as I go through this, and it's up at the bottom, I'm going to use this as a conversation piece. It's not intended for regulatory guidance or anything specific, so there's the disclaimer. So last time I was here, I think I alerted you that we had an investigation that started last year looking at the various manufacturers, and it focused in three areas. Were they following the licensing rules? Were they getting permits and inspections? And what code standards were being used for some of these structures? And we've closed that investigation. We've reminded the manufacturers that we're aware of their licensing responsibilities. We've defined what a traditional RV is and tried to wall off a regular RV, and you'll see in the pictures here from a little bit from these other structures that folks call RVs. We've eliminated the state program for temporary structures or park models because we found that our action was confusing local government and providing not providing the level of oversight to that particular area. And we've set up a temporary / permanent structure for these things to be regulated between the state and local government. So with that, I'll start where we first went. We needed to figure out what an RV was because folks use a lot of different terms. And so we've made sure that, and I'm going to show you some pictures here in a little bit, that when I use the word traditional RV, we're talking about a camping vehicle. We're talking about something that's met the federal guidelines for transportation. We're talking about something that's really an aluminum or fiberglass type structure. It does not have pitched windows. It doesn't have bay windows. It's not wood-sided. It is what you see going down the road as an RV. We also have made sure folks understood what a dwelling is because that's really kind of that's what lays things out. And if you've got permanent provisions, not permanent installation, but permanent provisions within the structure for living, sleeping, eating, cooking, and sanitation, you're a dwelling. Your temporary structures are your park model RVs, transitional housing, whatever anybody else wants to call their structure. I don't use the word tiny house because it doesn't really mean anything in the kind of the building code's vernacular. But that's a temporary structure if it's being used on a temporary basis. And there's a provision for those structures to be approved at the local jurisdiction level for 180 days. The standards are less than the full compliance with all of the trimmings and trappings of the building code. And then, of course, those permits can be extended on an ongoing basis. And the general requirement is that the building official needs to make sure that he or she provides assurances that the public health and safety and general welfare of that intended use is going to be carried out when they're addressing temporary structures. I guess the other thing to share is don't let the wheels kind of drive the discussion. It doesn't really matter from a kind of a life safety standpoint whether there's wheels on the structure or not. It's really how are they using it? Is it temporary? Is it permanent? Are people using it as a dwelling? And what kind of standards are these things built to? So licensing requirements is a big piece of this, and we need to separate the discussion for most of the bills here today talk about kind of permitting. I just want the committee to be aware and folks who are listening and watching, there's a lot of interest. There aren't any exceptions for whether you're building an RV or a tiny house or a temporary structure or any of that to not use a licensed plumber and electrician. Those are the rules in effect currently, and we have found that many of those builders are not using those services. Just as a point of information for the committee, most construction requires you to be registered through the Construction Contractors Board so that you provide, you know, you have an insurance, you have a bond, workers' compensation insurance is checked if you're a regulated entity. And there's a dispute resolution and mediation system for the consumers. We're not seeing a lot of folks having those registrations as well because when you call the product an RV, you're exempt from CCB. But again, you may use it as a full dwelling. And then I've talked about our licenses. So, pictures, so we can kind of figure out what we're talking about. This here is this is a small structure. This is a legally compliant structure that was installed in one of our metropolitan areas, and folks typically call these ADUs, accessory dwelling units. So we're going to assume that this is the house and that's the ADU. And there are provisions for these structures. They're usually around, some of them are 600 feet. We've seen them smaller than that. Again, license plan review, permits and inspections from the local community, and lots of custom features available for these things. This is an RV. Okay, I think that's fairly straightforward. And our definition, where we've tried to wall off RVs from these other structures, makes it clear that this falls under the RV program. Which one of these slides, Mr. Chair, we could have a little test. Which one do you think is the RV, as purported by the builder, and which one is the tiny house? Any guesses?
Well, that's not a fair question of the chair.
Okay.
Mark,
I'll move on.
I want to take
I
a
can't
guess.
See the
that sounded like a dodge.
I can't see the undercarriage. I can't inspect it as close as an inspector
should. Yeah, it's a bad
picture.
It's a bad picture, isn't it?
Yeah.
He also left our
well said, well said, Mr. Chair. Just so the committee's aware that this particular structure was purported to be a recreational vehicle by the person who built it, and this particular structure was purported to be a tiny house. We don't believe either one of them followed a dwelling standard, and when I show you the... And we clearly don't believe that the issues for this particular structure and this structure or set of structures are the same. We think that there's clearly a difference between those units just by looking at them, just sitting there on the curb. And that's why we attempted to kind of wall off the RV so that we can have a discussion about what's left and what are those gap issues between these types of units and then full dwellings or ADUs. So there's another... I won't pose the question to you, Mr. Chair, but it's the same type of question, is which one of these do you believe to be the recreational vehicle? Again, we were told, and the inspectors believed, that one of these structures was a recreational vehicle and essentially built to the same standard as that. And we think that that doesn't align with what the use is nor appropriate for the consumer at the end of the day. So just to kind of move along, because I know you got a lot of folks testifying on this, that's the RV, and that's the tiny house. This particular structure is in Oregon. We're not aware that it followed any electrical licensing laws, permits, and inspections that you would normally see for a dwelling or a structure that you would expect people to kind of live in or occupy for more than a temporary basis. That structure right there is what we call a prefabricated structure, mm-hmm. or a modular structure. That's a product that comes through the state. We look at it, we make sure it meets all the standards and requirements of a dwelling, and it's a fairly small structure. They can make them smaller. I think I shared with you, we have figured out how these structures can be built down to 160 square feet today legally. Unfortunately, we haven't had any of the folks that we work with go through the process, again, using licensed electricians, plumbers, et cetera, getting plan review and inspection to make sure that you've met the full requirements of the building code. That one is what we call a prefab. Now, just for a little bit of fun, this is an accessory building to a residential structure, and that's a horse. I thought it was a sheep at first. And this particular structure has electrical and plumbing in it and would require a permit from the local jurisdiction and a licensed electrician and an inspection on both of those components. And we find that that's maybe not in alignment with these types of structures where they didn't follow any of those regulations. So there's clearly kind of a disconnect out there in the world when you talk about these accessory type units needing to meet certain standards and go through a process, and then we found most of the units here did not go through any process that would be recognized acceptable for dwelling use. So I'm not going to... This is just a little description. We label the products so that they can clearly be identified. The top label is what's called a HUD manufactured home label. I talked about this last time I was here. This is under the federal program. Those structures are allowed to be anywhere in the United States and anywhere in Oregon where land use is allowed. This is the recreational vehicle tag. That's only going to go on as of January on that traditional RV structure. It will not go on those other kind of wood-sided structures that are called RVs by some, but really are a different type of unit. And then this is the prefabricated building, or the modular. And so when we inspect that particular unit, we let the local building department know what its occupancy classification was, what its roof live load is, whether it had plumbing, and all this information is put together so that the local jurisdiction knows exactly what they're getting and then how to look at it from either a land use planning or a setup and building permit standpoint. I am probably going to, just looking at the clock and what you have in front of you, this PowerPoint's available. We've gone through and kind of compared the building code to that RV code that built those other type of wood-sided structures and identified where they don't align. We've provided the definitions for folks because you can kind of see. I think one of the key points, because people like to confuse the issues, is even the RV industry, who writes the codes that these things are built to, identifies their structures as temporary, not for any use other than, I believe it's, was it a seasonal camping temporary use. And we find it interesting that folks are installing those in a permanent fashion, using them on a long-term basis. It's not designed for it. And when you go through the various standards and you compare the structural integrity requirements, the insulation requirements, the fire life safety, whether or not there's adequate blocking those kinds of things, electrical standards. You'll see, not expecting us to go through a kind of a code 101, it's stark difference between these standards, and I don't think that the people that actually put the park model code together think that it should be used as a dwelling, because even in their scoping they talk about that. So the other thing, just so you know, I'm going to move through this. I could quiz you on this, Mr. Chair, but I think you might take a pass on that as well. We've also provided guidance to local government on temporary structures. Temporary structures can be anything that somebody, just transitional housing, I want to put it in here for emergency, I have a special condition where I want to make sure that I can't comply with everything in the building code, but I want to deal with it on a case-by-case basis in local communities. Many communities are providing these services. Some are not. But they can, and we've provided guidance on what some of the minimum things that each local community should look at when you're looking at a temporary structure, so that you get that basic or that reasonable level of safety that that I talked about in the beginning. And so again, we just kind of go through each of the different things, making sure that you got your smoke detectors and carbon monoxide detectors as appropriate, and all the different things that you would want to have for somebody who's going to use a dwelling, and make sure we provide that kind of equal protection across the road. So I'll just kind of skip through these. We provided an appendix in our overview so you can kind of see what the different pictures were, and then we've provided the national definitions of recreational vehicles and park models, which again indicate that they're to be used for temporary purposes. I think you're going to hear about codes today and appendixes to read some of the prepared testimony that went on OLIS about codes that haven't even been printed yet. We find that curious. There are some changes coming down from the model code. Usually new codes are printed this spring and available the spring of the year for which the code comes out. So folks are talking about changes in 2018 that, again, we don't have a printed document on. And I'll just caution folks, a lot of the changes in the codes are creating alternate means of egress paths for folks who use sleeping lofts. And I'll just share with the committee and get on the record that means of egress, getting people in and out of buildings, was the first thing the building code ever did back in the 1900s, because that's the basic thing that we do. There's a whole bunch of other regulations over controlling smoke and fire and enunciation, et cetera. But the first thing we always do is make sure that if you're sleeping or using an area, we can get you in and get you out safely. So we would be concerned about areas that haven't been proven or tested that would change that basic safety feature. So in conclusion, I hope that we made it a little bit clear that when we're talking about RVs going forward, as of today, we're talking about that traditional RV, that aluminum-sided, and there's about 15,000 of those units sold in Oregon on an annual basis, that if it's going to be a temporary structure for whatever use, you can call it whatever you want, there's a path to work through local jurisdiction, and I think you'll see testimony from one of the communities that they have the tools that they need to do this, and it's occurring in these communities. If it's a permanent use, regardless of whether it's got wheels or not, it's a dwelling, and you've got the ability to go through local government and use the tools that we put in here, or you can come to the state, go through the prefab program. But at the end of the day, the licensing issues need to be addressed. Last comment. Because of the level because there wasn't much use of licensed electricians, plumbers, and all the various standards, we've alerted the various companies that are in this business, and we've made sure that they understand that beginning July 1st, we'll begin taking aggressive enforcement on those issues. We've got legislation on the Senate side to kind of clarify some of these issues, trying to wall off that RV from these other types of structures that I showed you the pictures of. So with that, I'll conclude my remarks.
So thank you, Mark. I know that your marathon coach, was it you that had the marathon coach? You don't live in it full time, and it meets all the residential requirements, I'm sure.
Yes, I will be doing that in about 20 years from now, Mr. Chair.
So I appreciate the primer. I know there's, you know, a lot of things that have happened in the last couple of years.
Sure.
with some of these tiny homes that were on wheels that are built on trailer chassis, and the department was giving them recreational vehicle certificates and then changed that.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I just want to make sure that, you know, we get a full understanding of this.
Mr. Chair, you brought up the sticker. The sticker's been something that's confused folks from day one. The sticker was only required if you offered a recreational vehicle. Yeah. And before we took action, the aluminum RV and those wood-sided structures were the same thing, essentially. That sticker was only provided when you offered it for rent, lease, or sale. It didn't have much to do with the construction. There were several exemptions. If it had been titled, it wasn't required. If it had come from another state, it wasn't required.
Right.
So there's really a lot of kind of policy areas that didn't align to kind of look at this issue holistically.
Well,
so
I do know that on
taking the requirement away for the RV sticker for the park models.
Right, and I do know that one of the proposals that was supposed to be in this legislation didn't get drafted correctly. It was supposed to require licensed electricians and plumbers on those tiny homes with wheels. I know you don't like that term, so that they could meet the recreational vehicle code otherwise. But That isn't exactly how it got drafted, unfortunately.
Well, Mr. Chair, just to conclude, I covered a lot of ground. We believe the law is clear today that there is a requirement, so we'll have to get legislation to exempt out the traditional RVs and have a conversation about the other ones as we move forward.
Okay, so up next, I'd like to have Tom Bowerman and Andy Hebe. Sorry, Andy. I'm horrible pronouncing names or remembering them.
My name is Tom Bowerman. I'm here to address House Bill 2737. In the written submission, I provided three documents. I hope you've had a chance to look at them. The first one is the actual text of 2737. Since the time that we proposed through my representative, Senator Barnhart, to address this issue of the crisis in homelessness that has to do, we're looking to solve the conventional workaround that's happening right now. A lot of illegal construction is happening. We believe that there is a void that needs to be filled with some clarity, and we have had the sense that it's hard to go through the Building Codes Agency because their mission is essentially narrower than the social issues of the cost of housing or the issue of homelessness itself. They may be sympathetic, but that isn't what the Building Codes Agency is really for. It's about safety, life safety, and quality constructions, and we fully embrace those goals. We have been working. I came to Square One Villages, which I'm an advisor to, 3 years ago, and in the intervening period of time, in that 3 years, the circumstances have changed. Opportunity Village was providing housing, emergency short-term housing, for in the zone of about $5,000 a unit. I was very interested in the, no pun on the term Opportunity Village, but I'm very interested in the opportunity, but also saw issues of quality control and safety and rodents and such as that. And I have been involved a lot in bringing some quality control and durability to this particular measure. And we're now looking at small houses that are about 200 square feet for the zone of about $25,000 that meet all of the conventions of efficiency, but most especially with focus on quality and durability. These are not tiny houses on wheels. They're intended to be what I call kind of hybrid permanent, but it's also the ability to put on lots in cities that may be a holding period for 15 to 20 years so that then they can be easily picked up and relocated for other uses, whether it be whether it's housing or not. But this is the intention is to have high quality, durable housing, and yet we find in dealing with our building officials now, when they first came at this in the city of Eugene, we had a different building official. He was more inclined, I wouldn't call it risk adverse, that's not the right term, but this building official, when he gets into the gray zones, tried to find a way to yes. We now have a new building official who is more cautious. We're running into problems that we had previously been told we were going to be able to do, and we're not able to do it. And so that's the environment that we find ourselves in and why we submitted this text, which now comes as 2737. But very interesting, this summer and through the summer, the International Building Code went through a series of committee meetings. That the International Building Code, as you know, is the platform of Oregon's building code. The residential building specialty code and the commercial codes are the International Building Code platform. And the International Building Code went through committees, and in December, I believe it was December, by a vote of the council of something like an affirmative vote of 165,000 out of 2,000 members, adopted an amendment. It's an Appendix 5, is what it's called, to the International Building Code, which is slated to come out in 2018. We submitted an amendment to the view that you see now of 2737 to amend that to include reference and inclusion of the new IBC proposed for 2018, and we then asked the legislature to expedite that process, because in Oregon it takes years to bring that forward. And I will also say that the International Building Code for years has had the ability, in the code itself, has ladder access and ship ladders into lofts. Oregon does not allow that, because Oregon has a more conservative approach to this. And even though it's nationally available, not in Oregon, and we're even afraid that if without particular action and guidance and encouragement from the legislature, if that's the right term, that we're looking for some degree of relief so that we can get these small houses on the ground and get people off of the streets and underneath the bridges. And also, there's a lot of interest by low-income people. The cost of housing since 1998, you may know, nationally has increased by $200,000 since 1998. We have a high crisis, not just in homelessness, but in the accessibility of housing. And we're finding, even in these homeless housing projects that we're working on, is that people want to buy into the house. They want to get their foot in the door in terms of being equity holders, and this is a way to do it. And we're looking for Oregon to provide some pathway so that we can get that done. So I think that's the scope of it. In the document that I submitted to you, it provides this bill that you see. It provides the amendment that we proposed, and it includes the IBC Appendix 5, which is gone through the vetting process. These are comprised of the building officials around the country, and so we feel like that's a good start. We thought that was a safer, more satisfies a lot of the things, rather than having a couple of people come out from Eugene and say, we want this, which is kind of of our own creation. This Appendix 5 is a fully vetted procedure, which we're really trying to get to, and would appreciate your assistance in getting us there this session. And I'm going to turn it over to Andrew now, and I'm going to, in case we submitted these just last night, you may not have seen them. It's just a one-pager handout. Gives you a little bit of idea what we're talking about: permanent foundations, using the building code officials, using licensed electricians and plumbers, etc. We're not looking for lowering safety standards or quality controls. We just want to find that, how to fill that void between the conventions of a 2,000 square foot house, which really do not work very well for these very small houses. To put a code stairway up to a loft takes up the full square footage of the house under the circumstances that we're trying to work within, in some cases.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Chair Hovey, members of the committee, my name is Andrew Heben, and I'm here representing Square One Villages, which is a nonprofit that's trying to develop a variety of models to use tiny houses to cost-effectively increase the stock of transitional and affordable housing here in Oregon. I thought I would give an example of a specific project that we're working on that's about to break ground here this spring. Emerald Village will have 22 tiny houses for people with extremely low income. We've gone through the land use process and received our land use approvals, and are in the process of trying to achieve building permits for these structures. They range from 160 to 300 square feet in size, built on a permanent foundation, and plan to be plumbed and wired, each with a small bathroom and kitchenette. We've gone ahead and selected our initial residents for this project. They'll be members of a cooperative paying $250 to $350 a month, which is affordable to somebody on part-time with part-time work or on supplemental security income, which tends to be around $700 or so a month. Yeah, these people are currently homeless because they can't afford a studio apartment in our state, and currently only one in every four people that qualify for housing assistance actually receives it. Emerald Village will change that for these people, and it's being developed for one-third of the cost, one-third of the per-unit cost of conventional affordable housing. The designs for these houses, which you can see on the exhibit of the handout or also on our website, demonstrate that this can be accomplished without compromise to construction quality, durability, or life safety. However, following the existing building code requires these designs to be far less efficient and more cost-effective than they could be. Examples include loft access, minimum room height and size standards, and insulation standards. For these issues, currently a 200-square-foot home is required to meet the same standards as a 4,000-square-foot home, even though, for example, it takes significantly less energy to heat or cool a small house. This doesn't make a whole lot of sense and disincentivizes smaller homes with a lower carbon footprint. The recently approved Appendix 5 of the forthcoming 2018 International Residential Code provides a critical step forward for addressing this very solvable dilemma. However, it may be years before this update is actually adopted at the state level. So we're here to urge the Oregon legislature to expedite the adoption of this appendix, which adds specific standards for dwellings under 400 square feet in size. In the meantime, we ask that local jurisdictions be given latitude to apply this appendix to ease the development of compact, sustainable, affordable housing. Currently, it's estimated that there's only 22 affordable and available rental units for every 100 extremely low-income renters in Oregon. So I'm sure, as you all know, we're in the midst of a housing crisis. Many cities around the state are looking to this as a model to cost-effectively increase that housing. And just to give you guys a scope of the broad interest we're receiving from throughout the state, we recently partnered with a group in Cottage Grove and are planning to build a similar project in 2018. We've also consulted with groups in Vinita, Medford, Roseburg, Portland, Washington County, Redmond, Bend, Florence, and Curry County, each of which is interested in developing a transitional or affordable tiny house community in their community. So we'd like to see some action so that we can actually move forward on that in a cost-effective way.
Thanks. Questions from the committee? Thank you for presenting today. Appreciate it. I'm going to take two more people, I think, if they can do it quickly. I'm going to bring up Ethan Nelson and Nathan Phillips. And you can sit at opposite ends of the dais.
Once again, for the record, Ethan Nelson from the city of Eugene, and Chair Holvey and members of the committee. I think for our input is that there is a housing crisis. Eugene, all of the communities across Oregon and the West Coast and the nation are dealing with housing and homelessness issues. We've got market solutions that are being pushed forward, free market opportunities that people are being innovative and trying to address situations and do so in an economic fashion. And I think that this is simply an issue where we need to look towards how do we effectively assess and protect fire, life, and safety issues for communities while at the same time allowing a code pathway forward in an efficient manner, provide clarity and consistency to the market actors to be able to get in, get out, and provide that service. And so with that in consideration, the city of Eugene would like to propose that around the mobile tiny houses issue, considering amending the definition of recreational vehicle and or residential trailer under ORS 446, such that mobile tiny homes clearly fall within the scope of BCD's recreational vehicle services program. Some manufacturers of mobile tiny homes are having their products inspected, approved, and labeled through the state's RV program, as we heard earlier, until BCD became aware that they were advertising their products as residences and homes. And so currently the ORS 446 defines an RV as being used temporarily for recreational, seasonal, emergency purposes. And so we have quite a range of uses, and I think that we need to be able to have a statewide program that provides guidance but also direction for those units that are going to move from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. And as the director said, there's guidance right now for temporary structures, but those temporary structures can get pulled from a jurisdiction where our building official may be much more lenient and innovative on getting to quote-unquote yes, and then that structure gets pulled and moves on into a jurisdiction where the building official is not as lenient, or vice versa. In regards to tiny homes intended to be permanently sited, we look to see that the legislation that would direct the director of BCD and Department of Consumer and Business Services to issue rules under ORS Chapter 455 incorporating tiny home provisions in the next edition of the adopted state building code in 2018, and considering these nationally adopted codes. And so we've heard about Appendix 5, and then there's a whole process that takes time. And so I think that we will probably get to a yes, but it'll take a number of years to get there, and in the process there's still needing to house people. Or the legislation could adopt the new tiny homes appendix that was approved during the recent ICC code adoption process and be published in 2018 in the IBC as the residential commercial code, or excuse me, the residential construction code. As long as the bill included a sunset of either 3 to 6 years until the next state code adoption, this would push the issue now, but eventually allow the provision to sunset and move on and put it back on into the code, not a statute. So that's where City of Eugene would like to be able to see. And if there's a work group that is being formed, we would wholeheartedly participate. We've got a lot of support from our city council, from businesses, residents, and also our building official and contractors and developers within the community.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And Nathan, if you could, 3 minutes or so, max.
I'll try. I don't think it should take that long.
Hate to do
maybe
that
to you. Maybe I can stretch it out then. Thank you, Representative Holby. I'm Nathan Phillips, and I'm here representing the National Electrical Contractors Association. As you heard, building codes has defined RVs to distinguish them from small homes and other wood-sided structures of that name, of whatever their name is. We're concerned about licensing standards and code standards. Our view is that small homes are residences, and the people living in them, regardless of their circumstances, face the same risks and hazards as those residing in larger structures, so they ought to be built to the same or similar standards using licensed trades. There's a legal way to build these structures following the existing code standards and licensing laws, and when the codes and standards need to be updated, there's a clear and flexible process for doing so. For example, I'm currently chairing the committee at Building Codes that's reviewing and recommending for adoption the 2017 edition of the National Electrical Code, the National Model Code for adoption in Oregon as the Oregon Electrical Specialty Code for the Electrical and Elevator Board to act on and then pass on to Administrator Long to adopt. We've received many proposals from the public to make adjustments to the National Model Code to accommodate conditions of use in Oregon, and if necessary, similar changes can be made in the building code to facilitate the construction of small homes. With respect to House Bill 2737, we're pretty strongly opposed to putting building code standards in statute. We've seen over the years where that is done, we end up with a very archaic and inflexible construction standards because statutes are difficult to change. Those of you who've been around here a while know that a technical fix in a statute is not such an easy thing to do. Code adoption in Oregon is done in administrative rule, which is much more flexible and responsive with extensive opportunities for public input. There are already codes and standards that can be applied to these structures. If they need to be modified, we have a way to do that, as I've described in the electrical code. Interim code amendments can be made if the three-year code adoption cycle is not applicable. The advisory boards at building codes can address a code amendment where the need exists, and the proponents demonstrate that they don't compromise safety. We at NECA don't stand in opposition of working to find ways to promote the development of sustainable, affordable housing or temporary transitional housing. We just think that all permanent dwellings should meet minimum safety standards and be built by qualified individuals.
Thank you. Committee, we're going to return to this subject matter. Thank you very much for your testimony today. You're welcome to come back at any time. But with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2165 and 2737. We will carry over House Bill 2165 and 2737 and 2168 to Monday. And we will carry over the work session on House Bill 2186, 2192, 2335, and 2336 to Monday as well. So did that cover everything?
Mm-hmm.
That I'll adjourn the House Committee on Business and Labor.
Yeah, the school's out.
Business and Labor.
Yeah, the school's out.